Hi, this is David Frangioni, CEO and publisher of Modern Drummer Magazine. So excited about our new podcast, the Modern Drummer Podcast. This weekly podcast will bring Modern Drummer to life. Sit back and enjoy fresh, fun, and insightful conversations with today's top drummers, producers, musicians, beat makers, and craftsmen. Whether you're a professional, a hobbyist, drummer, musician, programmer, producer, or just love music, this show is for you. Every other week, the Modern Drummer Podcast will feature world-renowned producer, songwriter, and drummer, Narda Michael Walden. Narda Michael Walden's Upbeat is featured exclusively on the Modern Drummer Podcast.
This is brother Narda Michael Walden, and I'm very, very excited, very, very proud to announce that we have this interview with the genius, 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 Mr. Billy Cobham. Those who know me, Narda, know how important this interview is to be able to talk and get rare behind the scenes, the real genius of Billy talking to us, how he became who he is, what inspired him through his childhood. And when I complimented him and said to him, you know, we all know about your genius with the fusion and the outer space, but the fact that your pocket's so deep is why I love you, from James Brown. He said to me, no one's ever said that to me before. So I got stopped in my tracks. I was so knocked out that I could say something to Billy that he had not heard before. So God bless you on this interview. I want everyone to watch it. It's very important to me, so I want it to be important to you. This is the great genius, Billy Cobham, who really broke barriers in music, sound, and life. Check it out. Check it out. Check it out. This is with my highest devotion, my highest respect to everybody. Love you, love you, love you. Narda Michael Walden, my new podcast, Upbeat with Modern Drummer. Check it out. Ow! You have just lifted our spirits so high with your drumming and your life and the way you live and what you do, man. So I just want to give you so much of my heart's affection for everything you've done and what you do. I just want to just tell you that from the jump street. Mm-hmm. What you put down from early days till now, we are all just like stepping back and awe of.
Mm-hmm.
And I personally love the way that you were able to mix it all together. For example, I'm a fan of James Brown. I know you remember James Brown. To me, I feel like you bring James Brown into the fusionary world, which is why I love you even more. Anything you want to say about that?
I'm trying to think of where that dance hall was in the East Bronx near the Yankee Stadium. I just got hired just on the off. Somebody got sick in his band. And I ended up playing with, I think that might have been, was it Spider Rice or somebody else was in that band just by accident. And I mean, I was more frozen in position than anything else. I didn't know what to do. I heard so many stories that I thought, let me make one mistake. I may not be here tomorrow. And somehow I got through that. Oh man, it came to me and then it left. See, that's what happens when you turn 76. Turn 76, you need to do it so you can understand what I'm going through. Anyway, there was that. And then out of the blue, Phil Ramone, what did he do? I don't know where I was. I might have been up at Jim and Andy's hanging with either Mel or Mel Lewis. No, it was Grady Tate. And somebody came up and said, Grady, they need somebody over at A&R 48th to do what? No, A&R 52nd to play with James Brown. And Grady said, you do it. And I went, okay. I didn't turn nothing down.
Right.
All he had to say was, you do it. I said, I'm on my way, you know? Yeah. So when I got there, what they give me? They gave me a pair of bongos. And I ended up just playing a little thing on a record called The White Knight or something like this, something about narcotics. But apparently, I mean, he'd done the voice and everything after that, and that was it. And that was the last time I saw him in person.
Oh, I see. Okay.
You know, I mean, oh, no, it's not. 1988, I saw Mr. Brown, he would never remember me, on stage in Sardinia, at the Sardinia Jazz Festival. I just happened to be on a holiday there. And I came in, I was invited to come see the show. And of course, they were beyond rocking. You know, they had it so down. Everybody was really, really, it was burning. And that was the last time I saw him. Yeah. So that was 1988. I never saw him again. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So what do you think about like a beat like Cold Sweat? What do you think about like that?
When those guys play, they play who they are, where they come from. That's right. And that's all they can do. Great.
Yeah.
But it's so, so sincere. And that's why it has lasting power. Mm-hmm. No one can play it like them, or could not to this day. We can all emulate bits and pieces of it and come up with hybrids. But what's his name, the drummer?
Is it Clyde Stubblefield?
Clyde Stubblefield. Yeah. Clyde had a thing.
Yeah.
It's just like talking about Al Green and the drummer with him. Yeah. It appears simple, but it's not. I mean, for those of us who haven't lived it, you know, it's difficult. And again, the reason to take a moment back, step a moment back and say something other than, oh man, it was a group. No. But those guys are there playing their life. Every note that comes out and it's not just out of the drum set by way of them. It's their interpretation of their history. So I'm listening to that and I'm trying to come as close to it as possible, because depending on how much the person who was not in, who is not the original player is influenced by that, they can only play what they interpreted. And some things might work and some things weren't. It's a good example for me would be working on in the music of Mission Impossible, but not being on the original date, or working on the original Shaft, or having my music on the spin-offs of Shaft, and doing jingles for the original Shaft, it's not the same, you know. The groove was just, again, just something very special, you know, played by specific individuals who lived with those people. They had a family, whether they liked each other or not. The respect was there, and that's what came out. So then we come, and we play a watered-down version, with all due respect, the best we can, with nothing negative about it, and put that forward for commercial purposes. As long as you keep these things in mind as a player, and you know, I'm not going to outplay this person or that person. I'm just going to do what I interpret as being how that was.
That's right.
You can never lose.
But I think that's why myself love you so much. You have such a reverence in your playing for the R&B and the funk of music, that when you go into fusion, meeting the Indian 9, 11, 13, all the odd meters, you are so pure in your sound, of your understanding of the funk, that mm-hmm. people like me from Kalamazoo, Michigan, I'm with you. I'm like devoted, because I hear in you what I love from James Brown, what I love from the R&B side. So mm-hmm. this is why I'm telling you, I think you're so unique. Not just because you're an outer space man, can do all this stuff. No, it's because you understand the damn pocket, man. God bless mm-hmm. your heart. I just want to just say that to you.
Thank you.
Yeah, yeah.
No one has said that to me, and but it's, I'm very happy that you understand. Well, where I'm coming from is, I lived in Brooklyn, you know, and in Bed-Stuy, you know. and on 89 Chauncey Street, and all that stuff that we were doing, from playing stickball in Robert Fulton Park and all of that as kids and all, to listening to in the big gazebo that's at the end of the park, Latinos playing unbelievable congas and stuff in the morning in the summer, every Saturday morning, because they wanted to go home. And that was their way of not just Latinos, but African musicians as well, drummers. There would be maybe 20 drummers out there, and they would be playing candomblé stuff and all of this. At 8 o'clock in the morning would start, and it would run at least until 12 noon. Non-stop, just playing. Quintos on top, and it all was relative. And then just across the street at around 11 o'clock, there was a bar called Dodgers. And they would open the door, and you would hear swing, funk, what black music wasn't funk, it was rock and roll.
Okay.
And all of this is coming out of the community. Mm-hmm. When you live that kind of stuff, everything is potpourri. It all comes in and goes out, comes out in your playing, you know? Right. And that, for me, I felt totally blessed, you know, that I could really hear this on, that was my Saturday morning before my mom took me downtown to go buy some stuff at Abraham and Strauss or something like that. But up until that point, all the rest of the week was, we had this big old Crosley radio that my dad bought, tubes. It was mono, of course, because we're talking 1952, 53, thereabouts. My brother, yeah, Wayne had just been born.
I was born the same year, Billy. I'm born 1952, the same as Wayne.
Yeah?
Yeah.
I'm telling you, the music that was coming out of that, and every morning, Monday through Friday, was WNEW, and you heard the top 40, which the top 40, right? Imagine the top 40, how blessed we could be to have Count Basie in the top 40, Ellington in the top 40, you know, Sinatra all over the place, big bands, okay, Ella, all these people, and that was AM radio. And I was like, what? I mean, for me, it was like when we got this FM thing, I said, oh, so now we got a better signal. I'm trying to get an understanding. And so we should get all of those people here. Wrong. And you know, I just went, okay, you know, I see where we're going, you know, but this is a land of misdirection, man. So anyway, the music was just so heavy. You couldn't get around it. And then you turn to, that's Eddie W. You had three or four other stations like that. And then you had the Latin stations. And it was like Tito Rodriguez, Tito Puente, all these people. And it was that every tune was on off the hook, you know, incredibly great. You want to just get up and dance out of bed, you know, before breakfast, and you know, but before you go to sleep, it was all this music, and it was normal for a kid. I mean, in my community to do that. Our one block was mostly Haitian, Panamanian, Haitian, Panamanian. Who else? Who else was on the block? Oh, West Indian, like this. Just one block between Lewis and Stuyvesant. And maybe three blocks back, you know, and that community, the music, the food, I mean, people were just, it was just amazing. On the corner, there was a corner drugstore. You could find, of course, they didn't have enough light, so you never knew what you were getting for sure, but you would be getting something very, very special from home, from down the south, easily, you know, so much. So rich, you know? Yeah. It was a blessing, man. It was a blessing.
So this is why you're able to be so versatile, hearing mm-hmm. all these different types of music that's in you. You can play any kind of music. It's because of this. Mm-hmm. This is the point you're making. So this mm-hmm. is what I say now. Then when rock came on the scene, just dead up rock.
Uh-huh.
When were you influenced by that?
I was already indoctrinated into it, but I chose not to, for some bizarre reason, go that route. I didn't want to be in a rock and roll band. I wanted to play in a big band. I wanted to play in Basie's band or Ellington's band or Stan Kenton. You know, all of that stuff was on the radio. I love that stuff more than anything else. And of course, then came Miles and Dexter. My dad, being a piano player, he knew those guys to some degree. Not Miles, but he knew Dexter and Dizzy. And so I had to go from time to time and just look at Jimmy Cobb. It was my first, that was my first drum clinic I ever went to at the Hotel Edison in like 1957 or something like this.
Okay.
And I'm there with holding my father's hand, because he knew by then I had already worked with him on somebody's drum set once or twice. He said, and a good friend of his was a guy named Specs Powell, who's a drummer that played on the, I think Specs played on the original West Side Story. Yes. When it was done. And he was teaching in town. I think he was teaching at Henry Adler's at the time in New York. And so, I don't know. I'm just walking and going with my dad and hand in hand. We get into this place and they're having a convention, the NAMM, the equivalent of NAMM show in a hotel. That's how it was, goes way back. And this drummer's playing. Dad was going to see Philly Joe, and we missed him. So the next drummer was Jimmy Cobb. Okay. And he's playing, and Jimmy never said a whole lot, never that I've ever known him. And when I saw him, Dad said, "Yeah, this Jimmy Cobb, he plays with Miles Davis." And I'm going, "Who's Miles Davis?" and you'll see, you know. And next thing you know, my dad's talking to this person, that person. I never knew these people. And Jimmy Cobb played, and I was like, boy, I don't know if I can, oh boy, you know, I better go back home and sit down and think this out, you know.
Yeah, okay.
I had a friend at the time. His name was Keith Copeland. And Keith Copeland's drummer, me and him went to elementary school together, and when we finally got out to Queens. And he said, "Yeah, man, my dad's a trumpet player, and I'm gonna see if we can't. He's gonna give me a lesson with Ronnie Bedford." I'm going, "Who's Ronnie Bedford?" And he said, "Oh, he's this drummer that works with the Johnny Richards Orchestra." And I said, "What's the Johnny Richards Orchestra?" And he said, "Oh, you'll see." And so I said, "Okay." He said, "Yeah, because my dad just bought me a new set of drums." I said, "Really? I want to come up. Can I come over?" And I come over, and after school, and he's sitting there on this at this Gret. No, it was like a combination Slingerland or something. Or other. The reason why I know is because, unfortunately for all of us, for me, Keith died, and he was Dr. Keith Copeland. Of the school for conservatory music in Mannheim, Germany, and also in Heidelberg. So he had a double doctorate professorial, and I ended up with his drum set. I took it from his wife because it was just sitting there. I said, "What are you gonna do with that?" And she said, "I don't know." I said, "Give it to me."
Yeah, give it to me.
And I just restored it, and, you know, kept it here at home. And but in the process, Keith had just, we started playing on that drum set. We're talking, I think I just got into, I was, can't be more than 12 or 13 years old by then. Okay. At junior high school. You know, and I was trying to figure out, what am I going to do? I think I'm going to be able to go to music and art, but high school, but I don't have any instrument. We couldn't do that. So, I didn't know. And to think about that drum set just reflects on all the stuff that happened to me just before I finally made the first commitment. And when I saw what Ronnie Bedford did with Keith, just showing him how to play, he wanted to know how did Joe Morello play Blue Rondo a la Turk and Take Five. And I'm watching this thinking, man, how are you playing five? I can't even play in three. I can't even play in four. You know, and this guy's doing five beats to one bar. How's that work? And then he went and played in nine. And I went, no, that now I'm scared. Right. Now I'm scared. I said, I don't think I can start. I can't learn all of this. And eventually it came. You know, it turned out to be just all phrasing and not about math as a proprietary foundation to be on.
Well, let's speak about that now that we're here. Mahavishnu would also speak about. He would say. The timing was and by the way, he sends his love to you. He said, got a hold of me last night. I told him I'd stop me talking to you today. He said,
is that right?
Give you his love.
I hope you're not listening, you.
Yeah. Give you his love from Monica. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But anyway, times were in shapes for him. So I'm asking you now, here you at listening to like five or nine when you were a kid was scary, but then you ended up being the master of this stuff. Speak about that. I mean, you took those things and just made them so comfortable, like our shoes we wear every day, that we can live now forever in what you put down.
Well, it starts with the funk.
Yeah.
Mark. I mean, it does. I mean, you have a foundation. It's a groove.
Yeah.
It's just not about the numbers. I mean, some of the things that I feel very, how can I say, holding to John about is that we never talked a lot in those days, much too much going on. And and one of the reasons why we didn't talk a lot in those days, because I understood that I wasn't the problem. There was so many other things going on. And the big thing was that he didn't have to talk to me to say and do what we needed to do, because we had this indoctrination period well before anybody else showed up. I'm not sure if it was Whitey Davis's place, Megaphone, or where it was down in Soho, but we hung out for, I think it was about a week or two, I don't know, alone. And at least the first 10 days was of always trying to figure out what was all this stuff in this small notepad that he had, spiral back, that he would look at, and you couldn't see his eyes. They looked like they were crossing, and he was, yeah, I want to do this, and then he would play it.
Yeah,
and he said, "Well, how can?" And all I could do was play in a way that would reflect the music that he was performing on the guitar, something to enhance that. Mm-hmm. Now, here's the Latin part. Mm-hmm. You put somebody down in a set of congas, they're going to play foundationally what they've learned on the congas, and it's going to fit somehow into everything that's happening because they're speaking language through the drums. And no matter where I go in Africa, it's the same. You sit them down and you start to play something that might be in five, and they won't think about five or six or 19 or 150. They will play something that reflects somehow and makes you feel comfortable about what you're doing. But they don't know what that is. I mean, they wouldn't know how to analyze it. Yeah. It's just what they felt. And I was flying by the seat of my pants, man.
Well, what about a jam like Vital Transformation, where you're whooping those hi-hats? You're bringing like Bernard Purdy vibes into those hi-hats. You know what I mean by that?
Yeah, I know what you mean by that. And Purdy doesn't even come to the picture. So let's not go there. Okay. I mean, I love him, but, no. But still.
Yeah.
So it was in that direction and more. Yeah. But it was just what I think I felt like what I was hearing was what needed from everybody else was what I needed to play to support everybody else. Yeah. Yeah. I don't know where it came from.
Right.
Narda, I have no idea. It just, it fit. And since nobody said anything, I figured I'd do it until somebody said something.
Yeah.
Nobody said anything.
I think you're a great arranger, Billy. I know you're a great drummer and all that, but I think you're also a great arranger, that you can hear something and know what to play that sparks it. I think on everything we're loving about your work, I'm hearing your creative juice in your arranging capacity, in your composing capacity. That's what I'm stunned by. Not just the fact you can do it, but you would think it. Look, for example, let's go forward. Look at Birds of Fire. That's revolutionary.
You're right, but look at Spectrum.
Okay.
Okay, I'll tell you why, and we'll come back to Birds of Fire.
Okay.
My influence, my inspiration was a 19-year-old kid named Bolin who would stand there, and I didn't tell him what to play, but he just looked to me like he would know, and he did not disappoint. He just laid it down, and I'm going, is this cat really 19? Nah, he's got to be somewhere closer to 60. I mean, he just was playing way more mature than I had. I didn't expect that. And it made me feel so comfortable to do that. Now we go back to not just Birds of Fire, but Inner Mounting Flame.
Yes.
And what's happening is that I had a very special relationship without actually knowing with Jan and Rick. I mean, the rhythm section was just solid. And to be honest, I didn't understand the value of the one person I haven't mentioned yet, but will, of Jerry Goodman until 2014. I mean, it just did not occur to me, you know.
Okay.
All I heard was a million notes coming, but I didn't understand what he was playing or even why. I was so embedded in the rhythm section and left Jerry to John. You know, it's like, I got no time for this. It's working, obviously, you know, in my own head. And then I started went back and started listening and said, my God, what? I was there for it. I contributed, but I didn't understand it. I was just not old enough in my mind and experience to actually realize why Jerry was there and what he was doing. And now I do. Yeah. And it's like, wow. You know, the beauty. But again, getting back to it's like some things take time, maybe a lifetime. You know, some things I still listen to Love Supreme, man, because I can't get past it. And I've got I don't have all John Coltrane records, but I have a lot of them, and they're sitting, and those LPs sit in my record collection. And every time I start to go to something else, I always come back to Love Supreme, you know, because it's so chock full of goodness. And I only need a little bit, you know. And that was the same thing with the MO. I mean, I knew at some point in time I was expecting that there was going to be a change. I mean, it's just we were working so hard, and I was getting sick from it without really realizing it, because I just couldn't keep up. I was getting very tired, and so I needed a break. And so when the decision was made to let the thing stop, but in our this situation, I went, you know, sometimes it's all about it's something up top that's saying, okay, that's it. You need to put this away for a minute, you know, because I was thinking about Moody Blues, and man, this is a band that could hang as long as Moody Blues, if we just had our heads on straight. And something said, I don't think so, no. That was the end of that.
Okay. Wow, man. Because I know stamina is something you've spoken about, and you mentioned one time about the power of breathing, how you had to remind yourself to breathe.
A simple thing.
Yeah, simple, but
I said to John one day, I said, man, I'm just playing everything I got in the first bar, you know. How, and we got 3 hours to play. what are we going to do? And he said, why don't you breathe? And I just was like, that's it? He said, yeah, just, you know, you can't play at that level of intensity in one bar. I mean, you've got to pace yourself. How about you play, take a couple steps back musically and try to get yourself through this thing. And if they can't, if everybody can't hear you, have a dinky, whoever, turn you up. That's it, you know? And it was like, a door opening. I went, hey, makes sense, you know? And, you know, things like that, understanding, being influenced by, we used to listen for one period of time, the concerto for orchestra, you know? And everybody would listen to it at the same time. And I got to tell you, I mean, I just enjoyed it. I was influenced by it. Yeah. And I thought, wow, wow, wow. All of this is happening. A lot of classical music. Yes. And you go, wow, yeah, man. But still, at that point in time, 71, 72, I could hardly put two fingers in a piano and make any sense of it. I only started writing after the last year of the band was together. And I was like, boop, 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 boop. That's it. I didn't know any other way. And because I felt like my big thing was I just wanted to contribute to help sustain the level of excellence in the band. It wasn't about trying to be I could never be equal. And one of the things I really wanted to do was not play or write like John. I wanted to bring something else. Hence, we come full circle back around to laying it down. Mm-hmm. And the reason why I just wanted to go back and back. Because everything else that was happening there was just so many, there's so much information. I mean, he overdid it. He pulled five geniuses out of the hat.
Hello, everybody. I'm David Frangioni, and what an incredible honor to have William Ludwig III, B3, Bill Ludwig, here with us today.
Thank you.
To talk about WFL3 Drums, his drum company for a while now, really, and get caught up to date. The Ludwig name is synonymous with drumming and literally put drumming on the map from the Ed Sullivan Show onward. But what an incredible history. Welcome, Bill.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me.
Well, such an honor. Catch us up on what you're doing with WFL3 Drums. How, you know, I think a lot of people are familiar with it, but give us a little history and then bring us up to what's happening right now.
Okay, sure. When I started out, I started with the aluminum shell snare drum. And then the next natural progression was the wood shell snare drum, followed by kits, which we introduced about 2 years ago at the Winter NAMM. So we've been doing kits now. And when I started out this whole concept of a drum company, I looked around what the industry was doing and saw that everybody was doing thicker shells, 8-ply, 9-ply, and different woods and crazy mixtures of wood. And I said, no, I want to go back to basics and go maple, poplar, maple, 3-ply, the way my grandfather did it. And we're very happy with the way that's going. Everybody that plays the kits now within seconds says, oh, the classic sound. And it just makes me so happy, because I was really focusing on sound when I started this project. And I know we got it with the snare drums, and now we know we've got it with the kits.
So wow, fantastic. So now are the kits, and I know exactly what you're referring to when you talk about that sound.
Yes.
I mean, maple Ludwig drums from the 70s, let's say, yeah, as an example, yeah, just have so much natural tone and resonance that the drums practically play themselves. They're so beautiful of an instrument, a sound.
And that's it, resonance, you know. And you have to have the thinner shells have more resonance and more tonal quality. And so if you start with that in the first place, it all comes together.
And are the now that you're doing these drum sets, you've been doing them, as you said, for a couple of years, are there all kinds of custom sizes and people can order whatever kind of kit they want, or are there pre-configured setups? How does someone go about choosing and or customizing, designing the kit for them?
Well, we just revamped our website in March, and we added a feature called Drum Builder. So you can do just that, going on site, picking and choosing the sizes of drums. We don't do all custom sizes, but we do the basics. And we can do something special if you know, need be once in a while, but we have the basic sizes, 8x10, 8x12, 9x13, and down. And then you can also go to the next phase of that and pick the color or style of finish. If you want a wrap, or if you want a stain, which we're doing beautiful fades and bursts. And now we also just introduced all of our sparkle finishes are a spray-on process that we've been working on for over a year to perfect. And we've got it. And it's just beautiful. We put the sparkle finish sprayed on the shell, then four coats of clear coat over that. And it really gives the sparkle almost a 3D effect. It gives it a deep look. And they're just, and no seams. You know, people were looking at the NAMM show at our new red sparkle and the blue sparkle and kept looking all around the drum and said, no seams. And they said, it's not a wrap. So that's really a big step forward for us.
That's huge. And what are the sparkle color choices in that, using the process?
We do blue, silver, red, Caribbean sand, champagne, and spice.
Awesome. So really all the colors people think about when you think about the different sparkle choices.
Exactly. And those are all, you can view those on our website, and they're just beautiful, beautiful finishes.
And what's the website address that everyone can go and custom configure their kit?
It's WFLIIIdrumsplural.com.
Awesome. And so tell us now about the snare drums. I mean, you know, Ludwig and snare drum could not be more synonymous if you tried. So what happened? I know that's how you launched the company, but what's exciting about the snare drums that you have and that you've been working on for a while now?
Well, as I said, when I started, I had the sound in my mind of what I wanted. I know what a good snare drum should sound like. And I started with the aluminum shell snare drum in conjunction with Trick Drums, who was helping me design the first series of snare drums. And he's a metal engineer, so it's a very precise shell, and everything's laser cut in the flat form. The bearing edge, the snare bed, the Roman numeral 3, which is our logo, through the shell. And I don't know if you can see this one behind me, but this is the 3 cut through the shell.
Wow. And, work of art.
And, you know, in the beginning, we thought, boy, that looks very sharp. However, we discovered with a bigger venting area, it gives the bottom head a little quicker response to the snare. So it is improving the sound and a snappier snare sound.
Amazing. Absolutely amazing. So, and, you know, these drums, everyone, you've got to hear them. To say that B3, William Ludwig III, is a legend would be an understatement. So to bring your years of expertise and drum making vision to WFL3 drums is a great thing for the drum industry and for drummers worldwide. Thank you for doing that, Bill.
Well, thank you. And as I said, the sound was the most important thing to me, and we just revamped our logo and our tagline recently to be WFL3 Drums, when your sound matters.
So I love it. Well, and that's what matters, right? Is our, as drummers, our sound is everything.
Sure. And I love it because I've gone back to the basic old school days, going to a concert unannounced with a wood shell and a metal shell snare drum, get the sound check, go backstage and just kind of bullshit my way in and tell the security guy, you know, I'm supposed to deliver these. Oh, go over that way. And so I end up meeting the drummer and say, you know, here, would you just try this? And many times they've tried it at sound check and then turned and said, I want this drum. And I said, well, I'll get you one. No, I want this drum. And they tell their manager, pay me, and they keep the snare. So,
well, it doesn't get any better than that. I mean, that says it all.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. And so, you know, everyone, you got to check out these drums. Now, I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you, do you have a memory that you want to share or a story from the Ludwig days, maybe with Ringo or during that heyday? Or what do you remember? What's a fond memory that had such an impact on you that you're still taking with you to this day? Because these drums are the heart and soul of what you created with your dad and grandfather over a century. And I mean, this is so significant in the world of drumming. What, you got a memory you want to share with us, inspire us all? As only B3 could have.
Well, the one that really sticks out is, you know, this whole starting over again goes back to the days of my grandfather in the 1930s when he sold the company. He started over again. He couldn't use his name, so he started WFL Drum Company and put William Ludwig President. So now here I am so many years later in the same boat, can't use my name, starting over. And I don't know if you ever saw the famous picture of my father giving Ringo the gold-plated snare drum.
Yes, I've seen that photo. It's iconic.
Ringo, you know, was kind enough when I was out of the industry for so many years to still let me come to his concerts when he'd come through Chicago with the All-Stars. And not only would he allow me to go to the concert, but I was the only person allowed backstage, which was really cool. I mean, I was out of the business. He didn't have to do that, but he's just a nice guy. And we'd say hi and, you know, talk a little bit. So when I got around to starting this company and I told him about it, he said, oh, that's great. I wish you the best of luck. I said, I want you to have the first drum I make, number one off the assembly line. And I'd love to take a picture with you like you took with Dad. And so he arranged that and let it happen. So there's a picture of me handing Ringo a snare drum, just the same as my dad did.
Wow, that's incredible. Is the picture on the website? Where do we see it?
Yes, I believe it is on the website. Or
talk to Kipton, tell him to get it up there.
Yeah, okay.
that is that's iconic.
Yeah.
And that, well, congratulations on that. That's a moment only, there's only three people on the planet that could ever create that moment with Ringo: your grandfather, your dad, or you. And the lineage and the history and the time frame that we're talking about, it really only came down to one person on the planet that could have possibly had that moment and that time period kind of repeat and start the cycle over. Absolutely incredible.
Yeah, thank you very much. That really meant a lot to me. And, you know, as I said, he didn't have to do that. He didn't have to, you know, say anything to me after I left, after I was separated with the company. So, but he's a nice guy.
Well, he's a nice guy, and it also says a lot about the integrity of the relationship that you and your family established with Ringo. I've had the pleasure of getting to know Ringo and work with him, and he is an amazing man, just an incredible human, on top of all the other iconic things that he's accomplished musically. But he is also a man of incredible loyalty and integrity, and you have to earn it with Ringo, as you know, and you clearly did, and you had a lot of years to earn it or not.
Right.
So it says a lot about, you know, how you approach business and drumming, and congratulations for that, and congratulations on WFL3 drums, because, you know, there's nothing really new about the drums other than the company being new. You know, everything else is so established and so tried and true.
Right, but one thing that was drilled into my head growing up by my grandfather and my father was customer service. and quality product. So if you do that, everything else will just come together. So that's what I strive to do. And that's the really fun part of this now is you call WFL 3 Drums and I answer the phone. And people say, wow, I can't believe a Ludwig answered the phone. I said, well, it rang. So, you know, but in this day and age of all the push one to talk to this, you know, department and two for that. And it is exciting to be able to talk to somebody.
Well, it's exciting and it's absolutely awesome to have those values persist. I take it that at some point at Ludwig, maybe even a long period of time, you guys did the same thing. You had real people answering the phone. You had people had access. It was very family driven.
Absolutely. I worked several summers in high school in the customer service, you know, phone desk, and I'd answer the phone. Hello, this is Bill. Can I help you? Well, what's your name? What's your last name? Ludwig. What? And the people, they would get so flustered by it. And when we got busy, my dad, the calls would bounce into my dad's office and he'd answer calls. And again, people couldn't believe a Ludwig was answering the phone and they'd get so excited, they'd forget what they called about.
Well, and that's awesome because that's truly the essence of customer service. And on top of making such great instruments for so many years, and you're making great instruments right now that are brand new, cutting edge, they have, you know, tried and true, you know, experience behind them, but there's so many new things that you've figured out better ways to do. But that core of family values and taking what you learned through all of those years to build the Ludwig name to why it's so significant in drumming, a big part of it is that approach. And I love the fact that you're doing that at WFL 3 Drums because we're missing that in the industry. We want that. Drummers want to be able to talk drums. I mean, there's really no bigger investment that a drummer makes than in his full-blown main kit that he's going to use. That's really his heart and soul of what he's investing in. And you know that. And you're putting that into a customer service, experience that's awesome.
Well, thank you. Yes. And made in the USA, you know, which is really cool because you could stop by the factory. It's in outside of Kansas City. Anybody's ever on tour or wants to check out some drums, come on by.
Wow. Well, you heard it here first. B3 just invited you to the WFL3 Drums Factory. When I'm near Kansas City, I'll be there. Bill, thank you so much for taking the time today out of your schedule, for sharing your wisdom and all of the new products that you've launched with WFL3 Drums with the drumming world. Thank you, Bill.
Thank you very much. And I'd also like to say one more thing, if I could, because everybody knows what's coming after Black Friday. Ho, ho, ho. And please go to our website and check out the gift coupons we have for Christmas this year. First time we've done that. People can buy any amount of money they want, give it to their favorite drummer as a stocking stuffer. We also have a Black Friday sale going on during the 4 days after Black Friday and a Christmas sale after that. So check it out. Get your WFL3 drums under the tree, possibly.
Well, that's fantastic. And they can do all of that on your website.
Yes. Yes.
Awesome. So let's tell everybody one more time, because you got to check out this website. You got to check out Black Friday, the gift cards, and the Christmas specials.
Right. WFLIIIdrums.com.
Awesome. WFLIII, which of course is for the three. So WFLIIIdrums.com. Wow. Happy holidays for that, B3. Great to see you as always.
Happy holidays to everybody out there and keep on drumming.
What's up, everyone? Mike Dawson here, managing editor for Modern Drummer. This is the Shop Talk section. And this week we are featuring two metal snare drums by Noble & Cooley. If you're not familiar with Noble & Cooley, they are a company based out of Massachusetts, and they have a history that goes all the way back to 1854 when Silas Noble and James Cooley started making drums in their kitchen. And then those drums went on to be used by the Northern regiments during the American Civil War. So this is one of the original drum companies in the United States. They also ushered in the boutique era of drum companies in the 80s when Noble and Cooley drum sets came onto the scene. They're known for making, you know, old school but very contemporary sounding steam bent drums from scratch. They're still making all of that stuff. In fact, if you want to check out their wood shell offerings, check out the new Union series that's made from tulip wood, which is what the original Noble and Cooley drums were made from back in the 1800s. But this week, we are talking about two of their metal snare drums. Another classic Noble and Cooley product was when they teamed up with Zildjian Cymbals and made a bronze snare drum using Zildjian's alloy. But then, you know, so those are super popular and really high quality. If you can find one of those are special drums. But then they used cast aluminum to do another version. So that's called the Alloy Classic. And what we have for review here is the 4.75 by 14 Alloy Classic. And what they're doing different is they are now they're now painting them. So this is an alloy aluminum, cast aluminum shell that they painted with a high gloss silver sparkle finish. Super gorgeous. You wouldn't even know it was a metal drum unless you, well, if you try to pick it up, it's super heavy, but it looks like a lacquered wood shell drum, but it's actually aluminum. So we're going to check that drum out. It also comes with their proprietary throw-off, sturdy brass lugs, really high quality Noble and Cooley stuff. One of the coolest sounding drums. You'll hear lots of crack, lots of pop. So we'll get to that one in a moment. And then we also have a 6x14 raw copper classic series, which is similar. It's not a cast shell, it's actually a rolled shell, but it's thick, heavy copper, has that kind of big, robust rock and roll, modern rock kind of sound. That's 6x14, that has black chrome hardware, but it's still the proprietary brass lugs, brass throw off. These are some of the best sounding metal shell drums that I've personally ever played. You're going to hear a pretty big contrast between the Alloy Classic, which I think is a real kind of popping, kind of a smacky, real articulate sound, and then the copper, which is, you know, denser, bigger, fatter, more quote unquote rock and roll sounding to my ear. So let's check them out. So definitely go to Noble and Cooley's website if you want to learn more about these drums. Find a dealer near you to go check them out. They're pretty special. It was, I didn't like sending these back. I wanted to buy these for myself, but alas, they had to go to their new homes. But I did get to do a nice long demo that goes the entire tuning range of both of these drums. So it's about 6 minutes for each drum. And we're going to start with let's start with the 4.75 by 14 alloy, which is the Alloy Classic, which is aluminum. And then we will go to the 6x14. Copper, alloy copper. Here we go. Check them out. We'll be right back. So there you go. Hope you enjoyed that. That is the Noble and Coley alloy. That's the alloy classic aluminum and then the alloy copper. Two very exceptional metal shell drums. Check them out. The full review is posted at moderndrummer.com. If you just search Noble and Coley, you'll find it. There's also video demos of those exact playing performances. So if you want to see the drum in action, you can check it out there. If you don't subscribe to Modern Drummer, I suggest you do because I try to post demo videos of every product that we review in the magazine. So you can read about them and also see and hear them in action. So that's it. Hope you guys have a great week and we will see you next time. Thanks for listening.
Thank you everybody for watching this week's Modern Drummer podcast. Stay tuned for next week's episode exclusively on Podcast One. Until then, stay safe and healthy, and thanks for listening and watching.